Mas Masamoto, my compadre, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk with you, Tim. A great pleasure.
Yeah, and I know you're always busy. You're a farmer, so you're probably normally out on a tractor by now or something like that this morning, and yet you're taking time to talk with us, so thank you.
It's not a problem. I kind of enjoy a break sometimes.
Yeah, I bet. I bet you do. I mean, what a phenomenal book, first of all, Changing Seasons, A Father, A Daughter, A Family Farm. You wrote this book with your daughter, Nikiko Masamoto, who's also a prolific writer and fantastic performance artist and activist and all those good things. And this, the book is just phenomenal. It's wonderful. I loved it. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you, Tim. Well, I'm sure you understand the backstory of the stories in many different ways. And the way we tried to write this book was to convey that sense of transition that's occurring on the farm and also in broader food world and farming world and world in general, in terms of looking at, you know, stories of struggle with our family farm, my parents' story, my story, her story, but also looking at contemporary things too, of lessons we're learning today and also looking to the future of food.
Yes, those are all kind of on the external, right? I mean, some of the things that you mentioned, you know, sort of how farming and the food sort of culture is changing and, you know, all those are on the external. But, you know, the book also, as you're talking, as you and Nikiko are writing about that, you know, the things happening around us, you're also very much addressing the internal, you know, the sort of personal, emotional, psychological landscapes, the landscapes of the heart. You know, your work does that. And that's what I love about it most is that, you know, you are addressing, you know, all of these things. And yet they're very touching and very sort of just personally moving also.
Oh, thank you, Tim. I mean, one of the amazing delights is that we daily get into these really, you know, intense conversations about life, be it about, you know, everything dealing with farming, but also broader issues about the arts and how the arts play into the work that we do, or policy or politics and, you know, different things. Certainly this last couple of months with this crazy presidential election, we daily had conversations about, you know, roles of women and terms of looking at immigration issues and how does that impact what we do or just our attitudes that we have. So every day is a kind of this wild day. It's just fantastic.
It is. And when you say we have these conversations, I assume you're referring to your daughter, Nikiko.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about one thing, or she'll come in and start saying, "Dad, did you see what that happened last night on the debate?" And so, yeah, I was watching that, and then we get on this tangent, but then most of the time it gets pulled back to both the personal and also to the professional, because, I mean, examples, you start thinking about immigration issues, that really affects exactly our day-to-day operation. But then we'll start talking about our own family. I mean, my grandparents immigrated from Japan and were farm workers, and my parents were farm workers, and then there was the World War II relocation of Japanese Americans. So this whole notion of race and immigration, all those stories get woven in to what we do today on the farm.
Right. And, you know, what makes, I think, your voice and Akiko's voice so distinct and so vital is that, you know, you're straddling both sides of that as a farmer and as this two community-minded and active individuals. You know, you're on both sides of that. And typically, that's not always the case. You know, normally the case is that, you know, you're either with them or against us, as, you know, as they say, you know. And in your case, you guys really kind of know how to navigate or have been working on navigating the two.
Yeah. And one of the challenges, too, is we're not, you know, like journalists or scholars on a sabbatical doing a, you know, 6 month research and then write a book about it. We have to live with these decisions that we make. And as you know, Tim, this whole landscape here, one of the challenges is, you know, we live in a rural area and things change slowly. So how do you grapple with that? And it's hilarious because I see in my daughter, myself, when, you know, I came back to the farm and wanted change to happen really quick. And, you know, so she's very, you could say, impatient or at the same time, just full of energy and wants things to happen. And I find myself sitting there nodding my head like my dad did.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Nodding his head saying, you know, things just sometimes take a while. And she goes, "But Dad, I don't have a while."
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
I want things to happen now.
Yeah, yep. And, you know, as they say, the peach doesn't fall far from the tree, right? So, you know,
not at all.
Yeah, that was that. That reminds me of something. I remember one time driving with one of my, I think it was my daughter, who's now 12 years old. I was driving with her down the back roads there in Central California. And I don't even remember what she said, but I found myself laughing at what she said because it was that kind of a realization suddenly, like, oh my gosh, now I knew what my father was like nodding about. Now I know, I get what he was nodding about. And so I found myself suddenly laughing at that, like, here I am in that. And then she looks at me like, why are you laughing? And then I realized my father started laughing too at one point. And now I know what he was laughing about. He was like recalling that his father was nodding also at one point too, and he was finding himself in that news in that same situation. So I love when those little moments sort of, you know, all link back to us in that way. But you know, Moss, I want to kind of rewind a little bit, and before we get into a lot of these things that your book is about, you know, one of the things that's most intriguing to me, and it's always something I wanted to ask you over the years, is that, you know, you're a farmer. Like, you know, you're constantly working, you know, you're always working, and yet you're so prolific as a writer also. You're hammering out books, like, you know, every harvest season you have a new book, you know. So like, how do you find time to write?
Well, it, to me, and I think it's similar to you, Tim, in your writing too, where it's part of your life. It's what you do. So the literal example is I have a notepad I take with me all the time. So I'm out in the fields and I'll think about something, or something strikes me, or an image. Often it's a detail about, you know, the dust that I'm breathing in, and starting thinking about what's the nature of dust and how this is something that all civilizations have dealt with, breathing in dust. Yes. And then what does it mean then? So I write a note about, you know, the dust that we breathe into our lungs. And then I almost start sounding like a poet.
Yeah.
Dust that we breathe into our lungs have been the same part of the working hands that touched the earth for centuries. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, wow, this is really interesting. And I go, but I'm kind of getting way out there. So I'll start writing another note thinking about, you know, dust is a working class sense of how to deal with the land and how to deal with food. And then I'll write a real detail about, you know, what does it mean about dust this year? And it means that, you know, we're still in a drought in California. And what does that mean? And so I try to be very specific about what I do, write these notes, and then the notes then get translated, transformed at times into the germ of a story, the beginning of an essay. Like all good writers, sometimes it triggers something and sometimes it doesn't, you know, but you have to start with something. And I usually start with something very tangible. And that's why I have my notepad in the field to make those notes and little observations, or just a sense of the detail that is at the heart of the work that I do.
Right, and that makes me think of one of your chapter or your sections, your essays in here called Thinking Slow, which is really, it's kind of a, for our listeners out there, it's a section that's really, I think it's a series of anecdotes and even meditations and journal entries kind of, and, you know, where you talk about your process for journaling. And one of my favorite parts in that is you write, this is you write here, "My journals allow me to learn perspective. I can go back weeks, months, and even years to understand events in context over time." I mean, can you talk a little bit more about that, your process for journaling and what that does for you?
Yeah. I think one of the strengths and the powers of writing, right, is that you actually put words on paper or put it, you know, into a journal on a computer or something, that you're committing your thoughts to words.
Right.
You're committing your perspective to words, and you could go back and revisit those words.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's hard to go back and revisit a conversation because, you know, our memories aren't that good to really reenact an exact conversation you had a couple weeks ago, let alone a couple years ago.
Right.
But a journal, you could actually go back and then read that and then relive the moment and put it in perspective. Because I'll write something about, you know, the early conversations I had with my daughter when she said she wanted to come back to farm. And I'll reread that note now 3 or 4 years later and understand the perspective, the changes that happened. It reminded me when I first was doing a lot of writing. I lived in Japan for about 2 years as an exchange student, and I started writing a lot of journals then. And I look back at the journals and realize, you know, I was actually going through a relationship, a breakup, et cetera, et cetera, and how my words sounded like bad country western songs. They were awful. The writing was terrible. Oh, my heart is broken, and she stomped on it, and it was terrible. But it made me think of where I was at that time, you know, the idea of loneliness and how ill-equipped I was to deal with that.
Sure.
So I can read that now, laugh at it, and realize how pathetic I was. But journals allow you to do that. You could go back and look at things and gain perspective from it. So I really like journaling a lot.
Yeah, because you mentioned in there too, in that same section, about how, you know, looking at your notes from years past, you can also, you learn how to work your land or irrigation and things today. You know, you learn the history of it. And one of the other stories too, how there's a certain indentation in the landscape and a certain part of your orchards there. And that's the part that always gets filled with water. And therefore, you're always kind of mindful of that as you're driving your track. You know, you're always kind of keeping note of where the landscape of your past has been as a way to sort of navigate the future, the present and the future. And obviously, all of this applies to life, you know, and that's what's so fascinating to me.
No, thank you. And one of the fun things about doing it, not all the journal notes are like poetry. Some of them are literally, you know, dead tree, row two, you know, yeah, north end of the field. And I make it because I need to make that note in my farm management stuff. But there is something also where you actually acknowledge the dead tree. You know, you realize, wow, why did this tree die and the others didn't, you know, and realize, you know, some of the trees, you know, as a farmer, you're trying to balance this balance of life of making a living and getting, you know, profiting and return on investment versus the idea that you're growing a life
right
there.
Right.
One of the fascinating things is normally on the farm, they're not so black and white, right? It's more like dying tree or weak tree, row one, north side of the field. And you then have to suddenly say, do I want to keep that tree and maybe try to nurture it back? Or, you know, there are times in life when you need to do euthanasia. You need to put it out of misery and move on. And then, you know, it becomes like a metaphor for life, but it's also an everyday real decisions that you make. It's part of, you know, of living and trying to balance those type of things.
Right.
So that's, you know, and the wild thing, as I age, I'm in my 60s now, I start seeing things through the lens of someone, you know, in their later years of life. Issues of mortality start affecting me more. So I start looking at some of these old trees and say, you know, they're not producing as well, but, you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
I want to keep them around a little longer.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They still have purpose, you know?
Yeah. And you wonder, do riders go through that too as they age too?
Yeah. I don't, you know, I imagine. Who knows, you know? But.
And, you know, you're so young, Kim.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I could tell some days I just feel like not producing, you know, and I'm okay with that. Like, I long for the days of not having to produce, you know?
You get some rights as you get older, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. I think for me, it's after the 40 mark. I started to feel like, you know what? I don't have to always be so productive.
Right.
And, you know, and one of the other, and I'm going to kind of put you on the spot here, Moss, one of my favorite anecdotes in that same section, again, called Thinking Slow, is the one where you talk about the things that you normally don't ever write about. And then you go on to tell us about one instance, which is an anecdote where you and Marcy are first dating, your wife. And by the way, I should mention, Marcy's also just an activist and dynamo as well in her own right, and wonderful writer and artist too. And anyways, in your story, you talk about where you first begin dating her, and that year you couldn't get enough workers to help you pick your grapes. So you ended up picking them yourself before they all went bad. And Marcy had wanted to come over, and you asked her to not come over, but she came over anyways. And she ended up picking grapes with you until late into the night. And I thought, man, that's love.
It's young love.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's young love. There you go.
Yeah. It's that type of love where, you know, you just look at each other in their eyes and you'll do anything. And, you know, now it's like she'd say, you're nuts.
Yeah. She's like, all right, come on. It's already dark out. Get inside.
But again, and I think this is the joy that I get, and I'm sure you do too, Tim, of writing is the ability to capture in a moment of time, a snapshot, you know, who you were, what you're thinking, how you were, and be able to revisit that either through things you've written or just revisit it through like a rereading a note or something from a past journal and understanding perspective on that.
Right. We are speaking with the wonderful award-winning author David Moss Masamoto about his new book, Changing Season, a book that he co-wrote with his daughter, Nikiko Masamoto. And it's just a fantastic book that's just been recently released. You know, Moss, one of the things, as I was kind of doing some of my research, one of the things I really enjoyed reading was your website, because you guys have a family timeline on it. And your family, it shows that your family arrived from Japan in early 1900s. And then in 1942, they're relocated to an internment camp at the Gila River Camp in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the war there, they finally, they come out of the camp and then they buy their first farm, 40 acres, in 1948. And then it says that you were born. And then my favorite of all the marks on that timeline, it says 1972, Moss, quote, runs away from the farm to UC Berkeley. Now, were you running away from the farm at that time?
I was. Like a lot of farm kids, I could not wait to get away from the farm, but also, you know, leave this rural, small little rural community because I wanted to, you know, see what was life like in the big city on the other sides of the mountain where there was, you know, excitement and energy and vibrant arts and all these politics, you know, flowing and flying everywhere, and I wanted that enthusiasm. And I remembered telling my dad that I have an older brother who had already left the farm and became a computer engineer, and my sister had become a nurse, so she wasn't going to farm, and then it was just myself. And I told my dad right before I left for college that I'm never coming back. And later, I thought about that, and I probably broke his heart to a certain extent. Right. But sure. I remember he just nodded his head in silence. And I don't know what exactly he thought at that moment. Did I disappoint him? Was he hurt? Was he nodding to, in a very sage way to say, no, you have to pursue your dreams or your own life? It was probably a little combination of all of that. But he said in this very, you know, classic older immigrant family way, he just nodded his head. And then I went to Berkeley and had this great, crazy time doing all kinds of things. And the irony was, you know, I ended up coming back to the farm. So one of the story that I share is, of course, that my dad allowed me to come back to the farm because he also allowed me to leave the farm.
Wow.
So it's the same type of thing we did with our children. You know,
right.
So Nikito ran off too. And she went to Berkeley. And I remember she left, you know, within a couple months when I went to go see her, she had shaved her head. This is a new Nikiko.
Yeah.
I'm different. And I thought, this is great.
Yeah.
And I realized, or I thought she would never come back to the farm, which is fine.
That's what I was going to ask is, did you have any kind of maybe even just a gut instinct that she might return one day, you know, based on your own experience?
Not at all, because I thought as a young woman that's interested in the arts, very politically active, what would the farm have to offer her?
Mm.
And the irony is, of course, she has found her own voice and rhythm in terms of being a young woman, being a young artist, finding this niche in the landscape that she is, I think, thriving in many ways because she came back to the farm.
Right, so it's great. Yeah, and you know, I mean, not only did she return to the farm, but she's really kind of, you know, moving, I would say, Masumoto family farm in a new direction or in a kind of maybe an expanded direction, you know, what you and Marcy have done for years. But I think Nikiko's kind of almost kind of putting it at the forefront in a way. She's fusing the arts, activism, and the farming all as one, right? I mean, it's all one. And I'm wondering, you know, are those all aligned with your own sort of vision, the vision you might have had for your farm back when? Or is she kind of taking another path that you didn't envision originally?
Oh, I think she's expanding, transforming the farm into something new and different. I'm totally supportive of it. Excited to be part of this.
Right.
And at the same time, there's change.
Yeah.
And there's a new type of rhythm that's on it. And for me, that's hard.
Yeah.
I've gotten used to doing things, and the farm meant certain things to me, and she's taking it in a different direction. A simple example is that farming by its nature is fairly private. I farm in isolation, out in the fields with myself or family members or a small, you know, workforce of farm workers. It was tended to be fairly private. Well, Nikiko wants to just blow that up and have everything we do much more public, much more transparent in that sense. And it was that's different for me.
Yeah.
It certainly fits, you know, a younger millennial with social media and ability to see things through a very different lens. So that's different for me. And you know, sometimes I kind of have to stop and think, you know, do I want to be that public about what we do and how I do things? Or how do I allow her to be public, but to sort of maintain my own, not so much privacy, my own sense of reflection, I guess that's what it is.
Right.
The second thing is, you know, she's probably like anyone young. And when I came back to the farm, I probably hit this rhythm too. She's impatient. She wants things to happen faster.
Right.
You know, and that's where I catch myself thinking that, boy, I sound like my dad. Where it's like, you know, take your time. You know? You don't need to rush here. You know, we measure things in decades and generations. Wow. She understands that totally. And at the same time, there are things in the broader world that are changing in a very, very exciting and memorable way.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what I could get excited. Because, example, you know, being a woman in agriculture, what does that mean? You know, and we're on the cusp of another wave of change, I think, in terms of looking at, you know, gender dynamics and workplace dynamics and how does it affect things. And it's a very, very exciting time.
I know she pushes that. And one of the essays that she has in here is The Feminist Farmer. And, you know, she talks a lot about that as well. And I mean, just the whole book is a really fresh look at, you know, a family farm. And I should add, too, we haven't mentioned this, but yours is an organic farm, you know, and you write about that process. And, you know, I think that's something huge to mention because you're working out of the San Joaquin Valley, the agricultural mecca of the world. And yet, you know, you probably have better numbers than me, but I'd say 95% of those farms are not organic, you know?
No, exactly right.
And you've been doing this, and you were doing this since like the early 80s or something.
Right, through the 80s, we were one of the early, I guess you'd say, pioneers,
right,
fools that tried to do something. But, one of the fun or the interesting dynamic is you begin to understand that process of innovation and change and how, we were on maybe the cutting edge, but the key to understand is we didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
We just thought we were doing something that was right for us.
Mm-hmm.
And as things happened, we were part of a wave of change, in some cases leading the change, in other cases not realizing we're in the middle of this transition and change.
Yeah.
And I sense there's the same happening now in terms of agriculture. You know, organic certainly isn't a fad anymore, and it's broadening the definition of what is, you know, good food in many ways, especially for Nikiko. She's wanting to examine social justice issues in terms of our food systems, in terms of our, you know, treatment and work with farm workers. And what does that mean? And part of the, you know, untold story, and how is that part of the system going forward and bridging the gap between, you know, producer and consumer, a farmer and eater, and how are those things possible now in a way I would have never imagined because of social media.
So
there's these new ways that I'm sort of understanding and sort of watching and witnessing as she transforms what we do here.
Right, and you articulate some of that in a section called If Steinbeck Were a Farmer, you know, where you refer to the Grapes of Wrath, and which is written in, you know, 1930. And then you talk about how Steinbeck basically, you know, in that book, obviously, Steinbeck lets the farmers have it, you know. And in fact, where you're writing from and living and where you live and your farm is located is where the banning of Grapes of Wrath began, you know, in the Tulare County area and Kern County, in that area, you know. And yet you write about it from the point of view of a farmer, but also somebody who's mindful and active in the community. So it's just a really good sign of insight to that as well, what that looks like today.
In some of the real simple ways, especially when Steinbeck wrote that, you know, it was exposing this invisible world of farm workers and how it needed to be exposed. It was vital to be exposed to start thinking in terms of those contexts and, you know, realizing my grandparents and parents were farm workers, and they were part of all that invisible culture that was exploited in many ways and yet produced this, you know, huge amount of food that has continued to result in this very, you might call, you know, cheap food system that we have here.
Right.
What does that mean in broader contexts for not only farm workers and farmers, but also in terms of the general public, in terms of health? And what is, you know, cheap food impact in terms of people's lifestyles, and what does it mean in terms of larger systems that are evolving at the same time?
Right.
But in that essay, I am reimagining that because I think the lines are blurred more in many ways now. You know, we're certainly in my circle of farming, somewhat in the organic farms, but also the small family farm operations, how, you know, there is this new relationship that we have because there's clearly a division between big ag and small farming.
Right.
We look at the world differently. We manage to scratch out a living differently.
Right.
But one of the big changes is that we're able, I think, to partner with other, you know, food systems, other restaurants, other right. chefs, other enlightened consumers, other people who are thinking very consciously about where their food comes from. And that makes a difference. It, for a writer, it's a wonderful time because more than ever, people want to hear the story behind right. their food. And that's yes. where I suddenly realized, wow, I have some of the right skill sets.
yeah, you do. I would say that. Yeah, you and Akiko both. Actually, your whole family does, you know. But yeah, absolutely. So, Moss, you know, we've been talking about your wonderful book. Would you mind reading us an excerpt?
Sure, I'd love to read one.
Great.
I'm stirred by surviving another winter. I remember my father waking early each winter day on cold, damp, foggy mornings, and after breakfast putting on a jacket and gloves and heading out to the vineyard to prune. I watched him and realized he was trying to fool nature. By working each winter day, he was making a pact with nature, pruning as if to announce to the world he would see another spring and life arise from those dormant branches. As I grow older, I understand this more.
And that was David Moss Masumoto reading from his new book, co-authored with his daughter, Nikiko Masumoto. The book is titled Changing Seasons, A Father, A Daughter, A Family Farm. And it's out with Heyday Books, one of my favorite publishers, personal favorites. Moss, it's been wonderful having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, Tim, it's great talking with you. I love telling and sharing stories with a fellow writer yep. and someone from this valley.
Yeah, and you know, your books have meant so much to me over the many years, and you know, just keep on keeping on, and send my love to your family as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tim.
All right, Moss, have a good one.